Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Icewell podcast. I'm your host, Nadia Frontier. Today I am joined by computer engineer Dominic Jakes, who has spent six continuous summers at Halley 6 Research Station on the Brunt Ice Shelf in Antarctica. I do find it fascinating that Halley 6 actually gets its name from being rebuilt and repositioned six times to avoid being swallowed up by huge crevasses. So essentially the station just keeps up with the movement of the Brunt Ice Shelf. Not only does Dominic support science and engineering projects, develop software to permit the automation of Halley Station when nobody is there over winter, but he is also a professional igloo builder, and sometimes he even wears a chef hat. Dominic, please introduce yourself and tell us about the last 6 years of Halley.
Hello, yes, I am the sort of computer engineer at Halley. I've been doing that job for the last five seasons, and this coming up will be my final season. I do a mix of software development, support for the engineering projects and science, and then also do all of the what sometimes appears as banal and ordinary IT work, as well as the more exciting cabling work around Halley Research Station.
Wow, that is an absolutely huge job. I think it's probably the most varied job that we've actually had on the episode so far. So let's start from the beginning. What made you come to Antarctica?
I was probably sick or being sat down at my desk all the time in my previous roles. And a mix of that, wanting to move into sort of a more eco-science support role for a bit. A few people had recommended that to me as a place to look for employment.
And didn't meet your expectations?
I don't know that I came in with expectations one way or the other. I knew it was going to be very different, but I think it has, over my last 6 years, I've seen, we've passed through the COVID years, as well as more recently with all of the completion of the Halley automation works. It's been a much more fascinating and varied role than I would have ever guessed.
Can we talk more about the Halley automation works? Because we've had a few people roughly talk about it, some of the engineers, but they mostly focused on Rotherhithe, and it would be really good to hear more about what it's actually like at Halley, because it is so different to the other British Antarctic Survey's research stations.
Yes. I think the main thing that's different about Halley is that you have power generation on an unmanned station. So it's unmanned for 9 months over the winter. And the difficulties there are that you can't service the generators in any way. You can't man the refueling. So the refueling is done automatically unmanned. And fixing problems as they arise is much more difficult because you can only look at the data that you've got. So my work is split between supporting, setting up all that monitoring and control, as well as over the summer when I'm back to working remotely. I wake up every morning and look at all of the data and check that the station is still ticking over and escalate and investigate where required.
That is incredible. Okay, so we're recording this now in Glasgow. The majority of the time that you're working with the British Antarctic Survey, you're living in Perth here in Scotland.
Yes.
So you wake up in your Scottish flat and look at screens that are giving loads of information from Halley Research Station, and then you have to respond accordingly if there's a problem.
I'm quite a solitary person, so I forget sometimes how weird it is, but I've had people comment, because I have my little my office where I've got several monitors, with live readings of Halley at any one time. And I'll sort of sit there on a given day. And it's still being sat down at a desk and doing desk work. But there's something nice about the physical nature of the thing that it's connected to is actually quite a complex system that is there for, not a greater purpose, but its function is also non-trivial.
Absolutely. Actually giving and contributing towards science research and ongoing long-term monitoring.
Yes.
Yeah. Wow. So could you give us some examples of what would happen if something went wrong? What could you do 9,000 miles away?
As with most strategies, prevention is the best medicine. So you want to have thought through all of the failure cases before arriving at them, so that you've built systems that handle those cases. For the most part, the failure instances that we arrive at are things that we couldn't consider or work around. And so that's why like the constant monitoring is good, because it means that we can like see when something is going wrong slowly, and we can like start to input fixes. So that might normally be powering down things here and there. You know, we've got like lots and lots of redundancy, so there's everything basically has backups, so you can turn off the main duty item and check if the standby item works, and if that's the case, then you can highlight the duty item as fit for replacement, and then next season you come in and you swap that out and so forth. The most interesting project I got involved in at Bass was, so the generator we use is a micro turbine. It's like a small jet engine, quite sort of famous in the Bass circles anyway. The small PCs that control the individual parts of the turbine use a silicon-based flash memory. When that gets below about minus 50, you start to introduce low level, my understanding is atomic sort of stresses that basically cause corruption at a low level. And basically the individual parts controlling the turbine at large forget what they are. And that triggers an alarm and turns the turbine off as a safety feature. This was sort of, we couldn't work around this obviously. So one of the solutions that I sort of put forward was to reverse engineer the control software behind this turbine. And we then automated the fixing of these devices. So yeah, it was like the summation of about like 3 or 4 months of like very intensive, like looking at like ones and zeros and like Hexel day to like try and work out the control protocol, figure out like how that worked, and then actually test that. And it sort of has given Bass the ability now to, in those cases, step in and reprogram the turbine and turn it back on.
Wow. So were you the person that was responsible really for implementing that? So the ones and zeros, that's like binary data. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. So
that's like code that you can work on to implement it? Like, to somebody who's a complete novice?
Yeah. Or, maybe the best way to do it is sort of by like analogy. So you have a manager and their workers, and they're talking in a language that you don't understand. But what you do have is a microphone, and you can record the language. So you can ask the manager to issue all of the commands, and then you can record everything they say. And then slowly you can work out all of the things that match, you know, all of the patterns, all of the words that they use. And every time you don't understand a thing, you know, a word, you can like look it up and figure it out in slow time by looking at what it actually did, and then slowly build up an understanding of what the language does based on that. And so once we knew the language, we could then program the sequences ourselves.
But who created the language in the first place? Why do you have to figure out the language?
The language is built by the manufacturers.
Okay.
Who obviously were interested in the work we were doing, because it was of a benefit to them, you know. And I was like, what I would like us to be able to do with this language now is start doing these really difficult things, which is like reprogramming the devices at a sort of low level flash. The issue there is that a lot of the commands it wasn't clear what they were doing. In the analogy with the manager talking to his workers, the manager would occasionally issue this command and it wasn't clear what they were doing, but it was a very powerful command. And so we could speak the word, but we didn't know what the word was doing. And not knowing what the other consequences of that word might be was like the sort of risks that were highlighted.
This is an absolute, completely different world, especially coming from a biology background. Like, it is fascinating. What did you study in order to be able to understand how to read computer languages? Damn it.
I did physics and then went sort of straight into software and electronic engineering out of university. So went from a fairly mathsy background into a very computational background.
And what's it like when you actually finally get to Halley? Does it feel easier almost? Like, you've got all these challenges of Antarctica, but you've got access to the screens and machines, and if something breaks, do you have more control over it being in situ?
Yeah, it's a lot of the problems are solved by sort of being able to press a button on and off again, which you can't do from a flat in Perth.
Do you enjoy that transition to being practical?
Yeah, I do. I do. I think I enjoy sort of general work, so being able to flick between both is a privilege of the job. The part that is sometimes more amusing is like the dealing with the IT, I guess, in the more classic or traditional sense, you know, like when someone has a problem with their laptop or the like. And I, you know, as the IT representative on station, it sometimes is difficult to remember that that is a very important priority of mine, is to help other people with their computers.
Are there scientists or station personnel that have got regular issues with their computer that maybe you don't quite know how to fix because it's not really your area of expertise, right?
No, but I think once you understand computers fairly well, then you can start to have good guesses at what's going wrong. You can offer good advice. The difficult thing sometimes is trying to manage priorities, because someone will come up to you and be like, oh, you know, this is my personal laptop. I use it to talk to my partner every day and, you know, relax and unwind. And I'll be in the middle of what feels to me like a really important piece of my work, you know, taking the time to sit down with them and make sure that they feel heard and also understand their problem, give them a reasonable understanding of how long it will take me to fix that, and manage that amongst the general priorities of all my other work. I found that to be maybe they're probably like the funnest problem to solve, right? Is like how to keep people, you know, how to satisfy that obligation of providing support, but doing it in a way where people don't feel like they've been dismissed. You know, they would solve this problem themselves by looking it up online or taking it to a shop, which obviously they can't do.
And buy a new one.
Yeah. All of this. And so it's sort of something you've got to work together.
I remember you talking to me in 2020 when we first met about prioritizing and juggling all these different roles that you had. And on top of everything you've mentioned, you then had a chef role. What's that about? What happened in 2020? What happened in the COVID year?
Yeah. I forget about this. Well, not forget about it, but yeah, there were, you know, obviously a lot of decisions being made operationally about how many people they could send in or not. I think Hallie came down to sort of maybe 10, maybe 12 people. And I was sort of the 11th on the list to go after the chef in position 10, which I think is a fair order. And I think you know, you want a good chef before you want good IT support. Yeah, I think that season, the two chefs who were sort of queued for the job fell through for various reasons. And with sort of 3 or 4 days to go before the season started, yeah, I was asked whether or not I would consider chefing for the season and providing the local computer support at the same time. I had previous catering experience, and the idea of cooking for sort of 10, 12 people wasn't too much stress. I was like, oh, this sounds like a good thing to do. Ended up at Hallie in Chef White's cooking for the rest of the team. There's a brilliant photo of me somewhere programming away in my Chef White's. But yeah, there was a good moment of sort of juggling priorities when I was like skidooing around with a box sled full of butter, flour, a server, and a load of tools.
My vivid memory of when we met is we were both helping out in the kitchen. Yes. And the chef, Katie, and you've been on the Ice World as well, she was teaching you how to make bread.
Yes.
And teaching you like basic kitchen skills for working in a professional kitchen. How did it go? How would you conclude? Obviously, this is like 4 years ago, but how would you conclude that experience?
I think I got fairly well reviewed by certain people. Yeah, how do I think I did? I set myself the challenge of never cooking the same thing twice. And from trying to make the bread from scratch every day. The former was a fun challenge, but probably stretched it a bit. I tried to make this diabolical sort of sushi meal one day that was just, we'll never see the light of day. Yeah, the less I said about it, the better. But I got fined for it when I was crossing the line that season.
Crossing the line is crossing the equator on the ship. So you left on
the JCN.
The James Clark Ross.
Yeah.
Crossed the line at the equator for the first time, had a ceremony.
Yeah.
And then people put in into like a hat or a bowl things that they have against another person.
Yes.
Lots of people had written us about your sushi night and then slops poured over your head. Yes, in response.
Yeah, the two people that had seen it, I never served it, but I was trying to make sushi at Hallie was maybe a step too far beyond my culinary skill. The only point of controversy was that the bread I was making didn't fit in the toasters. There was this like mix between like the bread is good, but the bread is also untoastable, and they would have to like cut it into their, you know, the specific shapes.
Oh, how terrible.
Yeah. Well,
life is in Antarctica. Yeah. People have to cut their bread to fit it into the toaster.
But I think I was having a lot of fun making it. Some people maybe wish that I would just do things simpler rather than trying to make life more complex for myself. Yeah,
absolutely. And Dom, what's it like living on the Brunn Ice Shelf? How is it? Like, you've had so many seasons there. You've built an igloo that you rediscover each year.
Yes.
Tell us about it.
The igloo, which has unfortunately this season finally been declared unsafe. Yeah, well, I think it's seven...
Season, as in the season that's just passed.
No, the coming season, I've been told that I'm not permitted access to it, which I think is fair. I think it's 7 or 8 meters underground now.
When did you start your igloo? When did you build your first igloo? Was it not 2020?
Yeah, 21 maybe? It was like 3 or 4 years ago. And Hallie accumulates 2 meters of snow every year. So every year...
That is huge.
Yeah, every year the igloo sort of gets 2 meters further down. But I think the following year I built like a little trap door for it, and you'd like pop open the trap door, slide down. And then that turned into a fairly big shaft. And then it's a shaft of like a 3 meter ladder and then a slide down into the igloo.
I did hear that you have to get a special invite to go into the igloo.
Yes. Yeah. This is, it's a private space at Hallie is hard to come by. And I'm a very introverted person by nature. So I was building it largely in part as my own private space where I knew I could sort of, you know, go and relax and be alone. And a few people offered to help, and I was like, I'm really sorry, I have to reject your help, because if I accept it, then you have a right to enter. And I was like, this isn't me trying to be
my igloo.
This is my igloo. I was like, I'll invite you around for tea. So afternoon tea breaks, I'd have tea in the igloo, and I'd sign people up and bring thermoses out, and we'd have like biscuits and tea in the igloo.
Wow.
But yes, it was invite only, and very much my sort of private space.
How cold was it?
It doesn't get any solar gain, and it sits lower than everything else, so the cold air drops. So I never actually took a temperature, but I probably the warmest it ever was minus 10.
Oh, warm.
Yeah. Not too cold. Yeah,
that was quite a joke. Yeah,
but yeah, you had to drink your tea quickly. I've got a really fond memory of someone coming around on. I started it on like a Sunday afternoon, and they came around like Sunday just before dinner was served, and were like, oh, how's it going? And I was like, I'm going to call it Rome, because it's going to be built in a day. Queue like 2 weeks later after we'd had like hurricane winds and like everything had been filled in 3 times. And it took me 2 weeks to finish in the end.
I love that story. I don't even know about it. Like, you send me pictures every year state of the igloo.
Yeah.
But I suppose I didn't realise just how important it
was. No, it's, Hallie 6i, it got called.
6i.
Hallie 6 was the original name of the station. Hallie 6a was the name of the station after it moved. And Hallie 6i was the name of the igloo. Yeah. And my claim is that after Hallie stopped wintering and the modules became uninhabitable, I slept in my igloo before anyone slept back in the modules, which means that the igloo has been habitable for longer than the modules.
Than the modules. Yeah. I like that claim. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So apart from igloos, what else can you do for fun on the Brunn Ice Shelf?
On the Brunn Ice Shelf. So the main things are that's accessible to everyone are cross-country skiing, fat biking. The front wheels just dig in, and I think everyone has one go on a fat bike. No one has two goes, has been my observation in my career. But the thing that I've been fortunate enough to get involved in is the sort of Hallie kiting scene, which is if you're familiar with kite surfing, where you have a traction kite, and then rather than using a surfboard, you use a snowboard or skis, and I stick to skis. But that's a beautiful experience, and you get perfect clean winds at Hallie. So when the conditions are right, it's probably the best place in the world for it.
And what's it like interacting with scientists? Have you experienced that before?
Yeah, my background was in sort of science a bit, I guess.
Sure.
Physics at uni. So I know what scientists are like. I'm fluent in science.
As well as computer language.
Computer language, yeah. I can normally translate what a scientist is saying into what they want from me at a computational level. No, in my experience, all the scientists that have come through Hallie are very confident, competent, and able, and there's been no issues. I think sometimes it's maybe difficult to communicate how hard the thing they have asked to do is. Someone will say like, can we just do this? And it's like, I totally agree that in the real world, with lots of people and a shop to buy the things that you want, we could do this no problem. Here, what you're asking is close to impossible, or I need to build this thing myself. When I think you're on station and someone wants something, the next best thing for them might actually be very different. If someone wants something and I can only deliver 90% of it because of timing or resource constraint, then that final 10% might actually be like the critical 10% that makes that scientific rigor important. I need to understand the science to some degree, and the scientist needs to understand that computing works to some degree.
Yeah.
And so there's got to be that equal exchange.
It's definitely that uniqueness of Antarctica, and coming from the science background, there's just actually how many people you need to realize your science in Antarctica. Oh, already you need a lot of support in the UK, for example, or other areas, but in Antarctica it's just even more so. Like, you need to understand other people's job in order to be able to realize your science project. It's got like so many layers to it that are just like parceled up in order to get one data point, is the involvement of so many people. Well, Dom, thank you so much for all your time here. I would just like to ask you a final question. Yes. And you're leaving the British Antarctic Survey. We are October the 21st, 2024. Mm-hmm. You're going down to Halley for the last time.
That's the plan, yes.
In November 2024. So in the next month, you'll be at Halley. What is it that you'll miss the most from leaving your Antarctic career, which has been 6 years for an early career?
That's a difficult question. I think the problem solving, right? Like, the, you know, I think in the future, I expect that most of the problems that get thrown at me will be problems that won't be brand new. Whereas I think at Halley, you know, be it like, how quickly does butter defrost, or what do I do if there's ice inside the server? Like, you know, how long do I leave it? How do I dry this out? And the sort of novelty of that, right? And like the genuine creativity involved in solving some of those problems. Yeah, I think I'll miss. And then obviously I'll miss my igloo.
Dom, thank you so much for your time. It's been so insightful and such a different perspective to what it's like to work in Antarctica. So thank you.
No, thank you very much.
And that is Dominic wearing his many different hats at Halley Research Station. Since recording this episode, Dominic has finished his last successful season at Halley. Wishing you the best success in finding future interesting problems, Dom, and I hope that you can rekindle your igloo making skills from your Scottish home this winter. And if you would like to help contribute to making polar science happen, then do check out the many roles available in the job section of the British Antarctic Survey website from 6 different research stations. In our next episode, we have our first Arctic-related interview, where we will be speaking with Ian Rudkin and Henry Burgess about how to run a research station in the northern polar regions. I'm Nadia Frontier, and thanks for listening.